Hi, my name is Lena Fersch and I have been in love with improvised theater for half my life. Lately, however, things haven't exactly been great. Improv and I were going through a rough patch and I need some outside help. I really want to get the spark back in the relationship. So I decided to talk to improvisers from around the globe to seek advice. How can I make up with improv? Let's find out. My first guest on this podcast was Lisa Rowland from Bats Improv in San Francisco. Lisa is the artistic director of Bats, and she's also the founding member of two other groups from the Bay Area, one of which is called Awkward Dinner Party and the other one is Improv Playhouse of San Francisco. Lisa teaches and performs locally and also travels the entire world performing and teaching. I first saw Lisa on stage in San Francisco. That was back in 2013, and I just knew I really wanted to invite her to Würzburg one day. And she did come. In this podcast, we talked about what it is like to be an artistic director in times of corona. We talked about the comfort of wearing leggings all day, about what it is like to live in San Francisco, and of course, we also discussed my problem. So have fun listening.
So great that you're like taking a break, you know, like that you're like, all right, I'm gonna stop doing this for a while and see what else there is. And I think because for me and the folks that I play with, improv is such a deep part of identity that it can feel really hard to move away from it. And there's that old cheesy saying that says, if you love something, then let it go, you know, and then see, and if it comes back, then you know that it's the right thing. And there's this part of me that's like, yeah, get out of here, go do other stuff, like inspire different parts of your brain and different parts of your heart and see what comes. And if at the end you're like, oh, I really miss this kind of connection with people, then you get to go back to it. And it's okay if you don't also, right? So I feel like maybe the advice is like, it's okay not to patch it up.
Have you ever taken a break from it? Have you ever let it go for a while?
Well, so, not in my adult life, like not in my professional career. I have not walked away from improv for any significant period of time. But I've toyed with the idea several times and I've just not done it. You know, just being like, man, what would it be like to have my weekends like a normal person? And what would it be like to have, you know, like how does my brain work when it's not operating in this particular sort of special improv mode? And how do I, you know, it's like anytime something becomes default, I sort of am interested in what happens if we break the pattern. And improv, funnily enough, is built on being willing to be vulnerable and take risks. And when it no longer feels vulnerable, am I really doing it? Like maybe I need to stop for a while and see other people, right? Like see other art forms. I do remember when I was young, I did take a break from performing when I was in college. So I was like at this point that felt very momentous at the time, which in retrospect was not as momentous as it felt, but I was in the middle of my college career and I needed to decide what my concentration in university was going to be. Like, am I going to major in theater? Am I going to major in something else? Am I going to go for this? I attended a university that like people don't go to this university for arts. They go there for like engineering, like academic things. And so there was all this weird external pressure and the questions of like, am I doing this because it's a default? What do I really want to do? Da, da, da. So I took a year off of college and I traveled. I lived in Spain for the year and didn't do anything theatrical. And then when I saw my first theatrical performance after that, I wept. And I was like, oh, I need to be, this like touches a living piece of me that is important to me. And so I sort of got a renewal of like, yeah, move toward this.
So you've become artistic director of Bats, right? A little bit less than a year ago.
Yes. Just in the very beginning of March of of everybody's favorite year, 2020, I became artistic director. And shortly after, and it was like in the early stages of the pandemic coming to America, and the first decision that I was a part of was suspending performances and leaving our theater and canceling classes and not. Yeah.
It's not a very inspiring start, I guess.
You know, it's funny. At the beginning, it actually was sort of inspiring. I think in the early days, it was, we didn't know what we were in for, right? So it wasn't like, okay, you're going to shut down for a year and a half. We were like, well, we'll shut down for a few months and see what we need to do. And there was a ton of innovation and creativity and coming together and trying things. And it was exciting. And there was experimentation. And BATS is a really long running organization. Like we're 35 years. This year will be our 35th year. And it's easy for big organizations to fall into ruts and patterns. And and going all online broke us out of all of those. And there was this sort of, it's like, oh my God, like there's this whole new set of constraints and what can we do with this? And we got really curious and the depression hadn't set in yet. And the longevity of this thing hadn't set in yet. And so it was like a fun new toy in a way. And it didn't get to be what it was, but we get to figure out what it is and sort of utilize all of our improv skills to meet the unknown and see what's possible now and find out what's, you know, how we can use this tool. And I think improvisers had this unique ability to jump online and produce online content in a far easier way than a lot of our sort of brothers and sisters in the theater community who have a more set product. And it's harder to know how to put that online or what that even means. And you know, improvisers are like, well, give me something to play with and I'll play with it and I'll find out what's possible. And so, you know, at the beginning, it was like, whoa, this is crazy, but let's see what's possible. And then as the months wore on and we all just thrive on personal connection and a connection with the audience and seeing one another and hearing a response, and then it got hard. So it was not super hard at the beginning. Yeah.
How did you feel being a leader of this? Because you're in this new position, artistic director, and then you're leading a company through that crisis. Did you ever have pressure to come up with something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember making the call of like, all right, guys, we're doing a show on Thursday. We're just going to do it. And you don't have to do it if you don't want to. But anybody who does want to will be in it. And we're just going to figure it out. And like moments like that, like we definitely are a group. And in our group, leadership changes every few years. So there's not like this is this person's group. And they hold the artistic directorship for a decade or more. Or, you know, it's like I'm just finishing the first year of a 3-year term. And after that, I can decide whether I want to run again for artistic director or if there's a moment where anybody else can also apply and there may be a change. And so it really was conceived of and is acting like a collective, and we trade around leadership, and that has pluses and minuses, but it absolutely felt communal 100%.
What do you think makes a good leader so that people really want to contribute and be a part of something?
Oh man, I think, you know, this is my first real leadership role and it feels like real trial by fire because, right, I came in at a time when everything was turned upside down. And then in the end of May, everything turned upside down again when George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis and this racial reckoning began in the United States and around the world. And we are a predominantly white organization. And so leading through first the transition to understanding what it means to be an online theater company and trying to sort of notice morale and ensemble and how do we stay connected and how do we feel like an ensemble when we are distant, and a lot of the joy that we usually get out of what we do is missing. And then riding this second wave where it felt like, oh my God, an earthquake struck in the middle of a hurricane of,
yeah.
Now we have to look at like, oh, we have to take a hard look at our culture and how we can address our corner of the world when it comes to racial justice. And I don't know how I'm constantly feeling ill-equipped to lead through that. And I'm in I'm in that role. So I'm getting real humble. Mm-hmm. I'm getting real humble. But I think that the one thing that I'm learning is that a huge part of it is listening.
Are there things where you find it hard to listen? Things that really get you at your core?
I don't find it hard to listen. I find it hard to know what to do with what I'm hearing.
Oh, yeah.
I find it very easy to listen. I think I'm a great listener. And the hard part is recognizing that there may be different people in your organization who feel very differently about the same thing. And I can listen fully to both of them at different times and totally understand how they both feel. And then being in the middle of it is like, oh God, what do I do now? Like I see both of these perspectives so clearly and I can understand the feelings on both sides of this issue or decision or whatever. And finding my own voice and compass in the middle of that is difficult for me. So that's like, you know, I'm just like learning. I'm just feel like I'm in a like spiritual workout this year of, keep going. Like you just got to keep going and you just got to keep trying and you're making mistakes and not living up to how you thought you were going to be able to lead this organization because the organization is unrecognizable from what it was when you applied for this job and like trying to have compassion for myself and also for everybody else who's like doing the best that they can in a really impossible situation where they are missing out on their livelihood and their joy and their right, like their connection. And like no one's at their best during this. It's just a really challenging context. So yeah.
I have a question for you. Related to Corona, but going a different direction. Are you one of the people that are sweatpants and blazer for online meetings?
I'm leggings every day.
You know, the amount of leggings that I have went up 300%.
Yeah, I'm leggings every day. I'm also pregnant, and so they're the only pants I can wear. Right? It's like there's no.
What a good time to be pregnant! You can wear your leggings. Yeah. All day long, no problem.
Yeah. Right. All the time. It works out. It works out great. So yeah, it is actually kind of a good time. It's like, I don't need to invest in a whole lot of extra maternity clothes and I don't need to have a lot of options because I just need to swap out these two pairs of pants that I wear every day.
You know? So, you know, just to summarize, you've started a new job as a leader of a really big company less than a year ago. You're going, like we all do, you're going through a pandemic and you're going to have a baby. How does your head not explode at this point?
I don't know. There is a part of me when I got pregnant that I was like, well, sure. I was trying. It's not like it was a surprise. Like I was working for it. But when considering whether to like continue trying during this pandemic and like, do I keep going for this, even though everything else is like completely out of control? I was like, well, yeah, I mean, just throw another thing into the mix and we'll just figure out how it all works together. And sometimes my head does explode.
Well, that's fair.
I have an amazing community and I have allowed myself to cry in front of anybody. That's the truth. Is like, all right, we're just going to process things as we do and as they come. And I'm not going to try to pretend like I have everything together. That's actually been a Yeah, a big part of this is like, don't pretend you know stuff that you don't, and don't pretend you're okay when you're not, and just like let the feelings come and let people know that you're having them and then move through them. You know, it doesn't mean you don't have to do your job or take the next step or take care of your stuff, but like you're allowed to be having a hard time on the way.
You are combining improvisation a lot with mindfulness in your work, right? It sounds yes. like that's the thing in, you yes. know, in the situation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I am the co-host of a podcast with Ted DeMaison called Monster Baby, which does that, which looks at improvisation and mindfulness and the intersections of those two disciplines and how they both get at it and the different wisdoms that both disciplines have to offer any particular life question. The rules of improvisation are the closest thing I have found to a code that I want to live by.
Have you ever done work on film or TV? Were you interested in exploring that area?
Never.
Never?
Never. I was never interested. I knew I wanted to be an actor, and I loved being in a room with people. I loved the rehearsal process, and I loved the like getting into a scene and no one's going to call cut. Let's do it again. I just wanted to like, I just like, let's get into it and like chew on it together. I loved table reads. I loved rehearsal rooms. Like I loved script. I just like loved the act of creating live theater. And I loved the response from an audience. I loved it. And so even when at the beginning of my career, I was going to go to Chicago and be in theater, do live theater. And then I decided to stay in San Francisco for a while and do live theater. And then Bats, and I got sucked in at Bats and have never left. So, but I was never interested in film or screen. And I think part of it is that sort of disjointed process of making a movie or a television show where it's like little bits and you may not even be in the room with the person you're filming a scene with. And you know, that kind of thing. I probably would like it. I've never tried it. I probably would like it if I did, but.
So yeah. From what I know, I don't know that much because I haven't been in that area. But from what I hear, it's a different way of how people are together.
Just, what is?
Film. I think there's less of a communal thought. Yeah. And it's, you know, because there's so much competition for so little. So when I went to Los Angeles in 2013, that's actually when I first saw a Bats show later in that on that same vacation.
Oh, yeah.
So when I went to LA, I thought it was really fascinating and really scary at the same time. I thought so many people here really want to make it. And it's there's so much rejection.
But one of the things for me is that, and the thing that I love about improvisation is that it is it's an art form of how more than what. And I think in LA and in the film industry, there's one pretty narrow definition of making it. I don't know. I've never been in that. I've never swum in that water, right? I haven't sort of like been part of that crowd, but from folks who I know who have lived there and since left, it was like, I just realized that if I wasn't, there wasn't room to be chasing a different kind of thing. It was like, if you're in that current, the current is so strong in one particular direction and there's so much striving for getting to that prize that it was hard to sort of set your own compass. And improvisation is like, who really makes it in improvisation? So there's a nice sort of release of pressure. It's not like, you know, it's a smaller pond and making it doesn't mean celebrity. Making it means like, oh, I get to play with my friends in a lot of different beautiful places in the world. Like, what a glorious thing. but it's an art of process rather than product, rather than like, okay, I've made it, I'm in a movie and this movie exists and you can go see it. It's like, it's how we approach one another, and it's getting together to play, and it happens in the moment, and it's about an approach. And yeah, so it's all about the people and the connection between them rather than aiming for a prize, which is very attractive to me, who's like really not a competitive person. So I would be like, no, forget it. You know, it's like, I don't want to be running in that race.
Yeah, I understand. I think same for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how, so LA and San Francisco are very different cities. You grew up in San Francisco or close to San Francisco?
Yeah, like a suburb of San Francisco, a very suburban place, about an hour outside the city.
How was growing up there for you?
Fine.
Do you think there's like a certain San Francisco feel?
I love San Francisco. I'm like one of the, I feel like everybody kind of shits on San Francisco a little bit right now. Like it's so expensive and there's all this tech money and it's losing its soul and all. And those things are true. Like it's so expensive that the people who have made San Francisco and my experience of it joyful are being slowly shoved out of the city, which sucks. But I think San Francisco is so beautiful. And I do, there's like fewer visible weirdos around the city than there used to be. And I miss that. Like there used to be a real presence of like, yeah, you do you, like live and let live. And there's just real wild self-expression, but there's like art everywhere in the city. And I appreciate I really like it. I like that it's small and knowable. I love New York and it feels like a beast that would devour me.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of feel like I have an affair with New York. It's like, mm-hmm. I go there and I'm like so excited and so exhilarated. And I just like, oh God, I sort of buzz when I'm in New York. I just love the energy there. And when I come back to San Francisco, I feel like I can know this place and this place knows me. And I feel like I can grasp it a little bit. Whereas New York feels like you got to carve out your little corner of it, and that takes work, and it just feels so relaxing. San Francisco feels like a village compared to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and LA is like goes on forever, that like you can know
a piece
of LA or like a neighborhood of LA, but you can't, you know, I mean, it's just like, it's like a conglomeration of a bunch of little towns that have like come together to call themselves LA. And so it also feels unknowable a little bit as a town, but San Francisco feels like, oh yeah, yeah, I get this place. I get how the pieces fit together. I get the flavor of the different places. I know places to eat in all of the places, in all of the different parts of the city. And the fact that it's covered in hills means there's views around every corner. And I love, it's like physically very beautiful. The bridges, the water, the bay, the hills, the Victorians, the architecture, it's light. It's, you know, I love it. I love that.
You know, hearing you talk about it, I'm thinking maybe I should move there.
Yes. Yes, you should. You should. Come here.
Oh, it is a lovely place. I really liked it when I came and visited. I like the seals hanging, you know, around the, I think we went to a restaurant and we just watched the seals for a bit, which, you know, for me as a German also, it's just very exotic.
Yeah.
Because you don't hang around seals that much when you're living in Bavaria.
Yeah.
I have to tell you. So if you're, you know, if you're ever thinking about moving to Bavaria, you won't be seeing any seals. Just letting
you know. Great. Bavaria, not famous for its seals.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say you're a nostalgic person? You know, thinking about the weirdos that used to be in the city.
I don't know if that's nostalgia, or I think it's just something that I really value about a place, is that you get to be exactly who you are in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, as there is a greater influx of like tech money into San Francisco, some of that weirdness is homogenized. You know, it's like some of that is sort of, it's all, people start to look and feel the same, and it's rare to meet somebody who doesn't work in tech, and it's,
mm-hmm.
but they're still around. Like, they're still around, you know? There's...
Are you one? A weirdo?
I think so, kind of, you know? It feels good to be... It feels good to be an actor and an improviser and contributing to sort of supporting one of the cultural institutions of San Francisco. That feels good. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm like a closet weirdo. Like, you wouldn't know it looking at me. you wouldn't know it on the street, but I think that, yeah, I'm
happy to be doing... weirdo. I really like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
She looks normal, but she is a weirdo underneath it all.
Yeah. Yeah. She's not what you expect. She doesn't work in, you know, project management at the Cash App or whatever. It's like, nope, something else is going on.
Yeah. It's weird. Hey, there is this show called Silicon Valley that I watched, like a comedy. I've never really known anything about that. You know, it's huge, right? And I never really knew anything about it. And then I watched it and I thought it was quite funny. You know, everybody who creates an app basically says, we want to change the world. We want to make the world a better place. And it's just sort of the same presentation that people give, like different apps for, like, you know, an app that will tell you when you need a bigger size of shoe, or, you know, the crazy things out there.
Totally, totally. But we're going to revolutionize the way people play. We're going to revolutionize the way people talk. We're going to revolutionize the way people do their laundry or find a cleaning service or buy suitcases. I mean, it's like anything feels like it needs to be disruptive. Silicon Valley really captured it. That show really captured what Silicon Valley feels like. In fact, to a degree that I was watching it and I was like, I don't need to watch this on television. This is everywhere. This is like, these are, you know, I went to Stanford University, which is like right there where all of this is happening. And there was the episode that I watched had a couple of scenes filmed on Stanford campus. And I was like, I don't need to watch this on TV.
Too close to home.
I know these people. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But they nailed it. Like, they got good consultants on that script and they like really, from what I know, nailed the culture and the language and the, it's like you go to a coffee shop in San Francisco, and this has happened more than once, and you realize that the conversation next to you is somebody in a startup showing a prototype to a venture capitalist, to an investor, to somebody who might invest in their business. And it's like, oh yeah, okay.
Really? You're actually hearing those conversations?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That to me is really like living in a movie.
Yeah. It happens. This is Mark Zuckerberg has a house a block away from me. It's like, what is this? Like, what is, it feels like a movie sometimes.
You know, they're changing WhatsApp now. So I actually have a lot of friends who left it. I left it today. I left WhatsApp today. Yeah.
Did you?
I did. I didn't leave Facebook though. So I'm not even sure if that, you know, what
look at you. You're breaking up left and right. Break up with improv, break up with WhatsApp. Nice. Freedom. Yeah. Give the girl her freedom.
Exactly. I'm going to give up, you know, next thing, I'm going to give up clothes. I'm going to give up, you know, living in a house. I'm going to give it all up.
Go live in Bavaria. Go get into the woods.
Yeah. Go find some seals.
Go find some seals.
I'll find the seals in Bavaria. That's what
come
I'm going
to San Francisco, hang out in a coffee shop. Somebody might drop $4 million on you. That's sort of how it works.
It doesn't sound too bad. What would you do with that amount of money? If that amount was given to you, what would you do?
What would I do? The first two things that I think of are, I'd buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would, pay to convert a city hotel to housing for the homeless.
There's a lot of homeless in San Francisco, hey?
Yeah, there's a lot. And it just feels like, guys, we got to do something. We got to do something about this, because they're, you know, these are our neighbors. These are our people. Yeah, take care of people.
Yeah.
Those are the first two things. If I thought about it longer, I might change my answer. But those are the first two things that popped into my mind. Buy a house, which would probably eat up most of that $4 million, to be honest. And then spend the rest of it on like food bank, like feeding people and housing people.
Would you like to live more outside of the city at some point?
I don't know. You know, I really love living in San Francisco. Having a kid may change this.
Yeah.
Like, I live in a tiny apartment.
Yeah.
There's about to be two of us living here.
Yeah.
So it may change. My family lives out in Walnut Creek where I grew up, and I don't want to go there. I don't want to,
looking at your face, I believe you.
I sound so pathetic. Don't make me go there. And I love having them there, but I don't see myself there at all. And I like really love the community that I've built here. And I sort of love the chaos of cities, to be honest. I like everybody sort of piled on top of each other and running into each other and seeing a lot of different energies and characters. And I really like that. But if something came up that brought me out of the city, I'd go. Like, I don't feel like I'm diehard, you know, would never leave. I'm sort of open to what the moment seems to be asking of me.
Do you have like a dream place outside of the US where you'd want to live one day, you know, just for a while maybe?
Oh God, like anywhere, everywhere, outside the US. I've been to Mexico City. I loved Mexico City. London would be probably pretty fun. Paris would be awesome. I love Berlin. I mean, like, God, I'd go anywhere for some time, but I don't have a particular place that it's like this. I could live there. Do I? I lived in Barcelona for a long time and I loved it.
It's nice. Hey, it's a beautiful city.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It reminds me of San Francisco just a little bit.
Did you learn how to speak Catalan?
No, I did not. I could barely hold on to Spanish when I was there, much to the displeasure of a lot of the Catalanes that I encountered. They were like, come on, you're in Catalonia. I'm like, I know, I'm sorry.
How long were you there for?
A year.
Oh, for an entire year?
Yeah, or just under, maybe 10 months or something like that.
Okay.
But that was the year that I took off school. I like stopped out of university and I moved to Barcelona. I just like taught English and babysat and nannied and figured out what life could feel like off of my, you know, it was sort of the first time that I really deviated from the obvious next step. Like that was not the obvious next step. The obvious next step was like, great, enroll in the next quarter of school and like continue in your education and go forward. And I was like, I think I need this to feel a different way for a while. Like I need to see what life feels like if I make a different choice. And luckily I have wildly supportive parents who were like, okay.
Yeah.
Go for it. You know? And then this baby was sort of another time that I was like, this is a deviation from the obvious next step because I'm having this baby on my own, right? It wasn't like my partner and I got pregnant or anything. It was like, all right, like I want to have a kid. I wasn't with anybody at the time. I knew I wanted to be a mom. So it's like, all right, you better take things into your own hands if you're going to make this happen. And it was like, left turn off of the path of least resistance.
6 weeks to go, Lisa.
6 weeks to go. Yeah.
What are you scared of?
Oh God. You know, am I scared of it? I know that it's going to be super, I know that it's going to be super, super hard. Like balancing this on my own. Like just the overwhelm of like, my life will no longer be my own.
And it's scary for you to think, I can't imagine what life will be like. It's just going to be a very different life.
I'm not scared of that because I'm like, well, yeah. Like I sort of thought about that and I was like, yeah, I've loved my life so far. So things can feel different now. Like we get to do something different now. You know, it's like, I know that I'm not going to be traveling to festivals very much in the next several years. And I know that, loads of things will be less available to me, but I've had a really solid run and I've loved the adventures that I've had. And so it's like, okay, if that stops for a while, I'm okay with that. And like, I know that my life is going to change in dramatic ways and I'm sort of excited for what those are. And there's something that I think actually will be grounding about having a little baby to take care of, because it'll be like, not easy, but simple in a way for a while, where it's like, listen, this kid's got to eat, sleep. I need to tend to this kid's needs, which are pretty consistent. And so that really is going to be clarifying for me about like priorities and like where I spend my time and what's important. So I'm kind of like curious and open to that. Like I'm not scared of my life changing. I don't feel super scared about it. I know that I'm going to hit walls and I wonder how that's going to be. Like I know that there's going to be times when I'm just like at the end of my available resources and then I've got to keep going. And that'll be hard, but people do it all the time. So I'm also like,
you're in good company.
Yeah. Like you'll figure it out, you know, it's nothing I can't handle. It's not like it's going to break me. For good. It'll break me temporarily, but it's not going to break me for good. So
that's funny. Yeah. A friend of mine just said the very same thing. He had a baby 2 years ago and he said, one thing that's actually very nice is that you have this one thing that's a priority, not really a thing, you know, you have a baby and that's a priority. And it makes things simple because everything is clear now. It's clear what you have to do. And it's actually, he said it's physically very straining, but mentally it's actually calming him down.
Yeah, that's sort of what because I can be a little bit all over the place and I can overextend myself really easily. And there's a way, like I'm pretty social and it's like really hard for me to say no to stuff. And I just like kind of want to be out there, and left to my own devices, I will sort of move in 9 different directions at once. And so there is something that I'm sort of like, oh, I think this might be good for me to like focus my energies and my time and my life in one direction and see what that does, you know, see how that is. It'll be a really different mode, but I believe in the adaptability of human beings. So, and I feel like improvisation is about as ready as good a preparation as anything for parenthood and for single parenthood. Like, all right, well, it's going to take patience and curiosity and creativity and problem solving and forgiveness and failure, like being okay with failure. I practice all those things.
So, I guess it is good training, isn't it? Maybe I should really just make up with improv.
I think that's it. I think the nice thing is you've got the training. Here's the cool thing is, the cool thing is that improv training has prepared you for leaving improv for a while and seeing what's there. Right? Like improv, it's like when you date somebody who's really great at communication or something, and that person sort of teaches you how to break up with them when you know it's time. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation, but like they're like, I've been in like, yeah, relationships with people who are so good at sort of taking care of their own emotions and like teaching me to like take care of mine or whatever. It's like I learn a certain kind of thing from them that enables me to end the relationship. I feel like maybe improv has prepared you to like be curious about what is on the other side of improv for a while and see if it's like see what that has to teach you.
It's a nice way to think about it.
Yeah.
Lisa, it's been so great speaking with you. Thank you so much.
What a delight. I've loved talking with you as well. What a nice opportunity to catch up. Thanks for your great questions.
Well, I tried my best. This is my first interview, so thank you. I really appreciate this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I found it very engaging, and I hope your listeners do too.
All right. I'm checking that box on my list.
Okay, great.
So, Lisa, if people want to hear more from you, they can hear your podcast, Monster Baby, right?
Yes, Monster Baby. So I think you can go to monsterbabypodcast.com. I think that's right. If you Google, it's like you can find it on all the podcast places. Monster Baby. Number two, we have shows, like there are shows all the time at BATS. So improv.org is the place to find out about what those shows are. But they're every Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. California time, Pacific Standard Time. But they're also, they will be living on YouTube and Facebook also.
Great.
So you can find us that way.
Perfect. So that's really great for all time zones.
Yeah.
Great for a global community that we are.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
You are so welcome. Thank you, Lena.
That was the first ever episode of Making Up with Improv. I hope you guys enjoyed it and stay tuned for the next episode. Bye.